Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, and welcome to a new episode and a new series of Talking France. Thanks to all our regular listeners for tuning back in. And to any new listeners joining us, a big welcome to you. This podcast is produced by the team at The Local France. And while it's free, it's only made possible by our paying members. Thanks to all of you who've joined. And a particular thanks to the gentleman who emailed us to say he joined The Local recently to help keep the podcast going. Much appreciated. Right, this week we will explore just how big an issue is youth violence around schools in France. Is it out of control or just being exploited by those pesky politicians? We'll explain where foreigners buy second homes, but why fewer Brits are snapping up properties. We also find out why one French island is taking on Airbnb, and look at why drivers on French motorways could soon avoid stopping for the tolls. And the English language is just French pronounced badly. Who would say such a thing? And why, we'll reveal all. I'm Ben McPartland, your host, and for this new series, you'll be pleased to know I've invited back our regular team from The Local, editor Emma Pearson, journalist Jen Mansfield, and politics editor John Litchfield. Emma, Jen, John, good to have you back with us. We were off last week, basically because I had a holiday.
Yeah, tell us about it. How was it?
It was good. I fulfilled a lifelong dream, actually, by visiting the Dune de Pilat in southwest France.
The largest sand dune in Europe, I believe.
Yeah, that doesn't really do it justice, really, a big sand dune. It is incredibly impressive. Anyone been?
Nope.
I have.
Have you, Jen?
I've climbed it,
It is impressive, isn't it? You climb it. It took me 6 minutes to go from the sea to the highest point.
Oh, you timed yourself.
Which is about 80 to 100 metres high. The only thing I'd say is it is blooming crowded. We went up in the evening one day and it was so crowded we thought we'll go back in the morning, and it was even more crowded in the morning.
Yeah.
So, and that was in April. I imagine in the summer season it is heaving. But anyway, well worth a visit. Really recommend it. Jen, you've had trouble with something. You've had a fight with a French border control since we've been away, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. I went to the UK over the weekend, and when I was coming back, I was trying to explain that he didn't need to stamp my passport. And then he told me that I didn't know how to do his job.
Jen, we've told you before, don't get into fight with French border control. Just let them stamp your passport. You're not going to get kicked out. Right, let's crack on with this week's podcast. In recent weeks, one subject that has dominated newspaper front pages in France has been youth violence, particularly in and around schools. The incidents that sparked the headlines saw a 15-year-old boy killed following an assault by fellow pupils outside his school in the Greater Paris region, while two teenage girls were seriously hurt in other violent attacks in the cities of Montpellier and Tours. France was plunged into political row and a blame game about apparent out-of-control youth violence. Not for the first time in recent years, it must be said. But now mayors in at least two French towns, including Béziers in the southwest and Nice in the southeast, have decided to impose a curfew on young people. Emma, this all sounds serious business indeed. What's going on?
Yeah, so the mayor of Béziers, who's a man called Robert Ménard, he has signed a decree that imposes a curfew. Specifically, anyone aged under 13 is forbidden from being on public highways between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. unless they are accompanied by an adult. Now, he says he's doing this to cut delinquency in his town, and he also added that it will be a lesson in morality for the parents, because when they come to the police station, they will be given a hard time. Now, I think it is important to say here that Béziers, which is a very pretty, very historic town on the southwest coast, it doesn't have more of a problem with youth violence than anywhere else, but what it does have is a far-right mayor, Ménard, who I think it is fair to say is quite fond of an attention-seeking gesture. This isn't, in fact, the first time that he's tried to impose a curfew. He tried shortly after he was first elected in 2014. And at that time, his curfew was struck down by the Conseil d'État, France's kind of highest authority on these matters, on human rights grounds. But although you might see Ménard as maybe a bit of a crank, his proposal does seem to be garnering more support this time around. And in fact, the mayor of Nice, Christian Estrosi, he comes from the sort of the centre-right politically. He said he's also looking into whether similar measures could be introduced in parts of Nice.
Okay, like I said, these actions followed a wider discussion on the problem of youth violence in France. President Emmanuel Macron himself suggested there is a problem following the death of that 15-year-old boy in the Greater Paris region. Macron said, "We have a form of uninhibited violence among teenagers and sometimes among increasingly younger ones, and that schools needed to be shielded from it. But how bad is violence in and around schools, Emma? And is it getting worse?
Yeah, I mean, if you've been sort of reading any of the French press, you'll have seen a lot of headlines about violence des mineurs, youth violence, in recent weeks. But although those cases were undoubtedly shocking, there isn't much evidence that violence in schools or violence committed by young people is in fact on the rise, or indeed that crime overall is seeing any kind of significant rise. There was a report that we found by a government-backed body called the Direction de l'évaluation de la prospective et de la performance, bit of a mouthful there, in February, and they showed that on average there were 13.7 what they call serious incidents per 1,000 pupils reported in college and lycée, kind of like secondary schools, in 2022 and 2023, compared with 12.3 the previous year. So like a rise, but a very small one. Vocational lycées, which are kind of like technical colleges for older students, they had the highest rate of serious incidents, followed by college, secondary school. And then, as you would expect, nursery, elementary and private primary schools saw like much lower incidences. Mm. And what they call these serious incidents, they can cover any aspect of law breaking, including things like carrying a knife or theft, alcohol or drug abuse and physical violence. So it's quite a broad definition. But one thing that the figures show does seem to be on the rise is racism, anti-Semitism, xenophobia or homophobia. The figures actually showed that 8% of all of these serious incidents recorded included some aspect of discrimination like that, and that was double the number that was reported the previous year. There have also been a couple of large-scale surveys carried out on college students, so that's kids aged between 11 to 15. They actually show a drop in physical violence in 2023 compared to earlier studies done in 2022 and 2017. Fewer than 3 in 10 students said that they'd been sort of pushed around or any kind of bullying in 2022. 15% said they'd been hit, which is down from 19% in 2017. And 15% said they were involved in at least one group fight, which is again a fall compared to 2017. Overall, 91% of students said they felt safe in their school grounds, although that figure does drop to 75% of all students and 71% of female students once they get outside of the school gates.
Okay, interesting stats. Nevertheless, violence among young people is an issue that in recent years has flared up fairly regularly following similar high-profile and shocking incidents and led to accusations that governments are doing little to tackle it. Following these recent incidents, Emma, French PM Gabriel Attal did announce several measures, yep?
Well, he did, yeah, but honestly, this felt like one of those speeches that politicians give just to be able to say that they've announced a crackdown. You know, there wasn't a whole lot in it. Measures that he did talk about include expanding the compulsory school day for college-age students, so 11 to 15, to 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., and expanding a programme that already exists for residential sort of holiday schools for kids who are getting into trouble. And he also floated the possibility, or this is quite vague, of 16-year-olds appearing before adult courts if they're accused of a crime.
Okay. Could there be another reason why there's so much talk around youth violence at the moment then?
Well, I mean, those cases that you mentioned were undoubtedly shocking, especially the one in which the 15-year-old boy died. Although I think we should say that this does seem to be that it was a personal dispute between him and sort of personal or a family member related dispute between him and fellow pupils. It wasn't like a random attack. But I think that always would have caused shock or horror, and there would always be talk about it and people would be looking at ways to prevent that happening again. But yes, I think there is a political context to this too. We're approaching the European elections in which the far right are predicted to do well and Macron's party is predicted to do badly. Violence, crime and public safety are topics that Marine Le Pen and her party are really trying to make their own. And it seems like the Macronists are perhaps trying to show that they're being tough on crime as a way of combating the far right. That announcement from Gabriel Attal that I mentioned, it didn't have a lot of substance in it, but it did seem to be an opportunity for some rhetoric that was kind of, I don't know, a bit more old-fashioned right wing. What Attal actually said was, "You break something, you repair it. You make a mess, you clear it up. And if you disobey, we teach you respect."
Okay, this is a good point to bring in John Litchfield, our French politics expert, who joins us on the line from Normandy. John, you've written about youth violence for The Local recently. Is it out of control or are politicians simply exploiting it?
You know, this is a very difficult one to get at in the sense that, yes, there does seem to be a disturbing surge of extreme violence amongst a small minority of very young kids, 13, 14, 15, not just boys either, which is new and perhaps even more disturbing. I don't know. But overall, and this is very rarely mentioned in the French media or by French politicians of any camp, violence is not exploding in France. This is not the unsafest time to live in France. I mean, 30 years ago, there were far more murders or violent attacks than there are now. You know, and I think that context should be borne in mind, but it shouldn't actually disguise the fact that there is a serious problem of sort of almost completely unthinking violence amongst a small minority of kids, especially in the multiracial suburbs, but not just there, maybe. And, you know, in the sense, it's one with what we saw in the riots last summer, which in which there was this extraordinary explosion of violence, which didn't really seem to be connected that closely to the event in which a young kid was shot dead by the police. It seemed to be something competitive almost between the different suburbs to try and show who could be the most violent and the most unrestrained. So, yes, there is a problem, but it needs to be put in a wider context as well.
John, Macron hasn't tried to deny that there is a problem. He's talked about a form of uninhibited violence among teenagers and younger ones that schools needed to be shielded from. Does Macron and his government have to appear tough here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's impossible for Macron or for the Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, to say what I just said, you know, point out something which is a fact, that if you look at the figures on statistics on violence, 1995 or 1994 were far more violent years than 2024. He doesn't say that. He does say that he would be accused of glossing over the problems, of having his head in the sand, of not being close enough to people, because there has been, you know, exaggerated coverage of any small incident of violence in the right-wing press and the right-wing reaches of social media for quite a while, which is not to say that these two or three very, very nasty incidents involving young people should not be covered. They should. And as I say, there is something there that shouldn't be ignored or played down. And therefore, the government should be trying to find some way of coping with it or of blunting it. But, you know, even so, I think possibly they do seem to have just accepted the rhetoric of the right and the far right a little bit too much for my taste in some of the things that have been said.
Curfew's the answer, John.
Curfews, you know, the problem is, how do you deal with these kids? If a group of three or four kids are capable of murdering someone they know or murdering someone they don't know, is a curfew going to solve it? Is the threat of being sent to a boarding school going to solve it? I mean, these kids seem to be beyond all normal restraint or reason, you know, and I'm not sure curfews, which would affect everyone, including the sort of great majority of young people who don't cause problems, are the solution. Don't ask me what the solution is. I'm not sure that I or the far right or anyone else has a real solution to this. You know, it's something partly driven, I think, by social media, although social media shouldn't be entirely blamed. But it just seems to have played a part in all of these recent extreme events. And that is one area, I think, in which politicians seem to be, not just in France, seem to be incapable of knowing what their response should be.
John, just finally, Gabriel Attal has kind of announced measures and talked about a crackdown a year. Have you been convinced by what the government has done to tackle this?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the idea is that there should be boarding schools for the most kids that are the most detached from school and from society. They already exist, and that there are places in them that they should possibly internet. They're called in French educational slang, and maybe that isn't such a bad idea for some of the more marginal cases. But the extreme ones, I think, you know, there is no hope for them in that direction. Also, the suggestion that kids in the most violent and the most uncontrolled areas should be made to go to college from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Well, if they're not going in even the present hours, would they respect those hours? You know, a lot of it sounds kind of slightly desperate, looking for answers for going to look good in headlines, but whether that's going to make any difference, I doubt. But then I have difficulty in trying thinking how you resolve this problem. It's a minority involved, but it's a kind of disturbing minority. And how you respond to that when they seem to be completely divorced from any of the normal constraints of social life is a real problem. I don't think the government has the answer. I'm not sure that a future right-wing government would have the answer. And it's not just a French problem.
Thanks, John. And just a reminder to listeners, you can read more from him on our website at thelocal.fr. All his columns are available there. Right, we know France has been and still is hugely popular among foreign second home buyers. Whether it's a little pied-à-terre in Paris, a cottage in a quiet village in rural France, a chalet in the Alps, or a villa on the French Riviera, France has a lot to offer second home property hunters. But a recent study by the Notaire de France, those are the professionals you have to go through to buy a property, found that certain areas are more popular with foreign second homeowners than others. Jen, you're on hand to tell us which French departements are the most popular with foreign buyers, according to this new report.
So there were a few French departments that really stood out. But overall, we should reiterate that the vast majority of second homes in France are sold to French people, unsurprisingly. The Creuse department in central France came out on top for the highest number of foreigners buying second homes. And that high number was 8%. So 8% of the home sales in Creuse in 2022 were to non-French second home property hunters. It's worth taking this with a bit of a grain of salt, though, because Creuse is very sparsely populated and it has fewer property transactions overall. So it doesn't take too many home purchases to get up to that 8% number. And then the next one was Alpes-Maritimes, which is the département on the Mediterranean coast. And that also had a large number of foreign second home buyers. Understandably, people like Nice and they like being on the Mediterranean. So about 7% of their property transactions were to foreigners. And that same number, that 7% number, actually also goes for Ardennes, which is on the Belgian border. They don't have the same ocean appeal, but they are right next to the Belgian, Luxembourg, and German borders. So you've got more people coming in from over there. And after that, you've got the département of Dordogne and Charente, which are both very popular with Brits. And 6% of the property purchases in those departments go to foreigners.
Okay, you mentioned Brits buying in Dordogne and Charente, which has been common for years now. But how much do we know about where different groups of foreigners prefer to buy in France?
So Belgians are the biggest group of foreigners buying property in France. They make up almost 1 in 5 of the non-French, non-resident second home buyers. And as you might have expected, they tend to buy the property that's near Belgium. So in the Hauts-de-France region, for example. But they also favor Corsica, Occitanie, and Grand Est. Germans were the second biggest group of foreigners purchasing second homes. And again, they share a border with France. But they were the biggest non-resident homeowner group in the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region. And as for Brits, they tend to prefer southwestern France, and Americans tend to prefer Paris.
Okay, these figures also showed that purchases made by British second homeowners are in falling, quite interestingly. Emma, you got more info on that?
Yeah, so I mean, these figures do show that although Brits still make up a significant proportion of second homeowners, especially in Western France, so Brittany, Nouvelle-Aquitaine, which is the southwest, and Pays de la Loire. But that number has been falling steadily in recent years, and Brits now make up less than 20% of foreign second home buyers in France. And it does seem likely that this is Brexit related. I mean, the recession in the UK could also be a factor, and we had almost 2 years of varying levels of travel restrictions during COVID that might have put off some buyers. But Brexit has made a big difference to second homeowners. They can no longer just come and go as they please between their French and their UK homes. They have to either limit their stays in France to 90 days out of every 180 or get a short stay visitor visa if they want to stay longer. We did talk to a couple of estate agents who specialise in selling to Brits, and they said that they do still see a decent level of interest from Brits. But actually, Joanna Leggett from the Leggett Estate Agency, which operates all over France, she said that these days people are more likely to be looking for a French home to move to rather than a second home. I guess if you're going through all the faff of getting a visa, you might as well move here. But I think it's also true that the rise of remote working has made moving countries seem more feasible for working age people.
Interesting stuff. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Jen. We have more articles on this subject on our website. Now, Île d'Oléron on the west coast of France is known for beautiful beaches, salt marshes, tasty oysters. I'm not sure I could recommend tasty oysters.
What are you mad? They're delicious.
Tasty oysters, no chance. It's survival food. Anyway, white wine and the production of the fancy Fleur de Sel salt. It's not quite as famous as Île de Ré, its posher and more popular cousin just up the road or up the coast. But authorities in Oléron have recently found themselves in a row with property rental giants Airbnb. Jen, what's going on?
Well, basically, they're forcing Airbnb to pay up. As you may know, France has a lot of rules and regulations when it comes to Airbnb. One of those is the obligation to pay the tourist tax, and that's set by local authorities. Now, as the guest, you would pay this automatically as part of your final bill, and then it's up to the hotel, or in this case, the Airbnb, to send the money back to local authorities. But this is the subject of an ongoing battle between Airbnb and the island of Oléron, which you said, off the coast of Western France. The island's super popular with tourists. They get, on average, 350,000 tourists per year, and they are accusing Airbnb of not having paid the tourist tax.
How much money are we talking about here, Jen? How much do they claim they are owed by Airbnb?
Well, their goal is to get Airbnb to pay them 30 million euro, but we're going to have to wait and see whether or not they get to cash in on that full amount. As of last week, a court in La Rochelle agreed with the island and ordered that Airbnb would have to pay 1.385 million. Now, local authorities don't want to let Airbnb off the hook, and they're now appealing for the full amount, the 30 million amount. They see that 1.3 million as an important first win, and they want to keep going further.
Okay, that's a lot of money at stake. What's Airbnb's side to this story, Jen?
They've blamed, quote unquote, incorrect IT settings for failing to pass the tax along to local authorities after collecting it. But it doesn't look like the courts were too convinced by that.
Okay, how does this tourist tax work? Just remind us.
Well, you can find it all around France, even in places that don't feel very touristic. It's up to the local authorities to set the amount within national standards. And usually it ends up being just a couple of euro a night. The specific rate of the tax actually depends on the nature of the accommodation. So think rustic campsites versus five-star hotels. And then it's paid per adult per night. So children are not considered in the calculation of the number of occupants. For a furnished accommodation, municipalities typically set the rate between 1% or 5% of the nightly price per person, which usually, like I said, just corresponds to a couple of euro per trip. If you spend two nights alone at a three-star hotel in Lyon, then, for example, you would pay 3 euro and 30 cents total in tourist tax. So not a ton. The Paris region is a bit more expensive, though. The tourist tax ranges from 65 centimes for the most basic campsites all the way up to 14 euro and 95 centimes per adult per night at the fanciest hotels. And Paris actually just tripled their tourist tax. So the maximum amount that the fanciest hotels used to charge was 5 euro. Now it's almost 15 euro. And they decided to do this at the beginning of 2024 in order to collect more funds for transport projects.
Just how does it get paid again, Jen? How do I pay it if I go somewhere?
Well, as the guest, you would pay it upon arrival at a hotel or a campsite, either by cash or by card. Airbnb works a little differently. So they have an online system that's set up so that the tax is collected when guests book their reservation. So not at the time of stay. And it's meant to just be through their online system itself.
It's a lot of money we're talking about in tourism tax. I think in 2022, Challenge said that it was 148 million euros was paid by Airbnb. So what do local authorities do with this money? Can they just kind of do what they want, build a new school?
Well, probably not a new school. The profits of the tourist tax are supposed to be earmarked for spending that would increase tourism numbers or for any spending that's related to the protection and maintenance of natural areas that are important for tourism purposes. So probably not a school, like you said.
Yeah, so it's got to go towards improving what's on offer for tourists.
Yeah,
that
generally
makes sense. Okay, thanks, Jen. Now, let's turn our attention to language. La langue anglaise n'existe pas, c'est du français mal prononcé. Or, the English language doesn't exist, it's just French pronounced badly. Emma, this is a fairly provocative statement. Where's it come from and who has dared to pronounce it?
Well, this is the title of a new book by a French linguist called Bernard Secuglini. I've almost certainly mangled that surname. I'm very sorry, Bernard. But anyway, he's written this book and he does, I have to say, make it clear straight away that the title is intended as a bit of a joke. Obviously, the English language does exist. He accepts that. The title is, in fact, a quote from the ex-French PM Georges Clemenceau. He did apparently speak English, but it doesn't seem like he was very keen on England. His other famous quote was, "L'Angleterre n'est qu'une colonie française qui a mal tourné," which means England is just a French colony that went wrong.
That's quite funny.
That is quite funny. English and French do undoubtedly share a lot of words. Around 30% of English words have a French root, and another 30% have a Latin root, which share a lot of words with French. And the reason for this is historic. So is this journey that Bernard traces in his book, and as most English people will be able to tell you, Duke William of Normandy invaded England in 1066, and he became the King of England, known as William the Conqueror. But what happened next was kind of a social revolution, really. The English nobility were displaced, and William's knights, mates, family members became the new aristocracy and a French-speaking aristocracy. French became the language of the elite, and then it gradually became the language of diplomacy, administration, the law, trade, which basically meant that ambitious English people really had no choice but to learn French if they wanted to work in one of these professions. So for around 200 years, you have this kind of two-language system, and you have a lot of people in England speaking French, but for whom it's not their first language. And then gradually, from about the mid mid-1400s onwards, England and France once again begin to diverge, and English gradually becomes the default official language for official procedures in England. And it's these sort of factors, this journey, that Bernard argues accounts for some of the most interesting things about the English language.
Okay, tell us a few then, please.
Okay, well, first of all, English is a big language. It has around 170,000 words, whereas French has just 135,000 words. Mm. And he says a lot of that comes from the fact that it is basically a blended language. So like English people, they would have kept their own word for something and also sort of incorporated the French word for it. And the second thing is that, yes, it does share a lot of words, albeit with, you know, often different pronunciations, different spelling. But the words that they do share tend to be clustered around sort of these systems of administration, law, finance, trade, these areas where French was an official language for quite a long time. So, for example, okay, Ben, can you tell me what is the French word for government?
Oh, let me think now. It is government.
Basically, yes, gouvernement. But yes, essentially the same word. Parliament?
Yep, same. Parliament. Parliament.
Yep. Yeah. Authority in the sense of a local authority or a health authority,
Jen, I'll give you this one.
Autorité.
Autorité, yes, exactly. And there are absolutely loads of these that would be sort of recognisable to an English speaker. Likewise, in the sort of the finance world, French word for tax.
Tax.
Yes.
Good.
But impôt aussi.
Impôt also, but the umbrella term, tax. Revenue in terms of taxable revenue.
Revenue.
Yeah, exactly. Legal as well, you know, you can have avocat, cour.
Avocado.
And also lawyer.
It's an avocat. Ah, yes. Lawyer, yeah.
Juge.
Judge.
Yep. Magistrat.
Yeah, magistrate.
So there's obviously loads of these. But the thing I found most amusing was that obviously the French and the English managed to spend some time sharing insults, because there are quite a lot of shared insults as well. Bâtard.
Bastard.
Yep. Crétin. Yep. Imbecile. Brute. And stupid are all shared English. So maybe we can trace the fact they didn't always get on. So there are absolutely loads of shared words, but there are also more words that are kind of adaptations of French. So remember that a lot of people in English speaking it were not native speakers, so they start to kind of adapt the language to make it easier for them. Mm. For example, the literal translation of the French phrase for because, à cause de, that literally translates as by cause of, and by cause of gradually mutates into because in English. And then if you add in the words that originally meant the same thing but have changed their meaning over time in one language, you get even more. For example, the French word sensible, it actually means sensitive, not sensible, but it once meant this in English too. So the title of Sense and Sensibility refers to being sensitive in that sense. And the one thing that I found especially interesting in this is the clear class divide in the types of words that end up kind of Frenchified. So, for example, the word pig and the word cow both have Anglo-Saxon roots, while pork and beef both come from the French words. Pork, basically the same, and boeuf, beef. So when the animal is in the fields being looked after by English peasants, it has an Anglo-Saxon name, but by the time it's on a plate being eaten by posh people, it has a French name. And there's kind of a tendency in English for the more sort of everyday words to have Anglo-Saxon origins, while the slightly fancier ones have French origins. Mm. So in English, you might say to build, which comes from an English root, whereas to construct, a bit fancier, comes from French. But in French, you would just say construire for both. There's no separate words for that. Mm. And it's the same for to feed, which has an English root, whereas to nourish has a French root. And again, in French, both of those would just be nourrir.
All right, interesting. So if you mentioned the word sensible, that's a pesky faux ami or false friend, as we say. Is history the reason why we have these faux amis, why some French words sound the same as in English but have very different meanings?
Some of them. I mean, not all of them. Some of them just have from different roots. But yeah, there are quite a few where the word was originally the same and then one or other language has kind of changed its meaning gradually over time. Sensible is a good example. Monnaie is another. In modern French, monnaie specifically means like coins or loose change, whereas we use l'argent to mean money more generally. But in English, we just use money as the umbrella term for all things finance related.
I see. Now, pesky false friends or faux amis are the bane of language learners, definitely. Have you got a favourite or least favourite? Favorite one, Emma, one that you stumble on?
Yeah, the one that always catches me out is actuellement, which you would think means actually, but actually it means currently. If you want to say actually, you normally say en fait or something like that. But for some reason, I just can't stick it in my head that actuellement does not mean actually.
I think the one that got me, or I remember it getting me, was tongue, when my father-in-law asked if he could borrow my tongue.
What?
Yeah, but tongue is flip-flops, isn't it?
Okay.
I just wanted to use my flip-flops to go into the garden. I hadn't had a clue what he was on about. Jenny, thought of one yet?
Yes, I have thought of one. Aventure. Aventure is not the same as adventure in English.
Explain this.
Because aventure in French is like only sexual.
It's an affair, isn't it?
It's an affair, yeah. But aventure in adventure in English is just like you can go have an adventure at the theme park.
On a similar note, condoms, that's probably one of the most famous, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is the one that catches our English speakers all the time. Préservative. It sounds like it would mean preservatives in food, but it doesn't. It actually means a condom. But this is another one that has a historic root. So in older French, préservative is used for anything that might kind of protect you in some way. So, for example, like a herb you might take to ward off the plague, or a religious icon that people believe might protect them from the devil. So the first condoms were marketed at men in order to protect them from sexually transmitted diseases. So they just use this general term préservative, something that saves you. And actually, in old-fashioned English, you might still use preserve to mean to save or to protect. So, you know, when the Bible says God preserve us, he's not calling on God to add chemicals to extend our best before date.
Interesting. Can we just settle something before we end this segment? Frenchies love to complain about the English language invading their own, but it was the French that invaded English first, right? They need to just pipe down.
Well, you know, let's try and all be friends. But yes, actually, I think unusually for a French linguist, our mate Bernard would agree with you on that one. First of all, he says that, you know, any increase in English words which are used in French, and I mean, undoubtedly, there are quite a lot of English words that are used in everyday French, especially tech terms. But he kind of says that, look, this is hardly an invasion when you compare it to the actual invasion of French words into England after 1066. But he also says that a lot of these English words that are coming back into French now have French roots in the first place. What he says is, this isn't an invasion. These are French words that have gone for training in England and now they're coming back to us.
Love it. That's a fantastic quote. And you've written an article on this on our website, Emma.
I have, yes.
Fantastic.
I love my job. I just get to read really interesting books and then write about it.
It's a really interesting subject. You can find it on thelocal.fr. Thanks, Emma. And moving on to our final segment of this episode. Right. You're driving along a French motorway, you spot some red on your GPS route, and then you see the traffic jam. Everyone's slowing down, you fear the worst, and then you realise it's just another toll booth or péage. Are these really necessary in 2024, Jen? Are there changes aloof, perhaps, to get rid of these péages?
There are. So France is starting to experiment with making its toll booth, like the péage you just said, free flow or flux libre. These are really common in the US. UK listeners might be reminded of the system that's in place at the Dartford crossing. Mm-hmm. Basically, these free flowing tolls consist of sensors and a camera that scan the car as it goes through. And this means that you just keep driving and then you pay for your toll later on, either online or in France. You'll be able to also do it at the Tabac, which is a very French addition to the change. You can get many things at the Tabac. You should check out an article on our website for that. But the technology is also going to be able to tell if you have a prepaid toll badge or a télépéage in your car too. So in this case, you don't have to worry about paying afterwards since you've already got a payment plan with the badge. And then afterwards, if you're just going through the sensors, then you'll go online, you'll enter your license plate number, and then you'll pay the fee. Or like we said, you can walk into the Tabac and pay in person. You have to make the payment within 72 hours though, after crossing through the toll.
Okay, we should be clear. This is an experiment, you've said, Jen. What's the timeline? Where is this happening?
Yeah, so it's the very initial stages of this. The goal is to have free-flow toll booths in place along the A13 and A14 motorways. These are the ones that go along the Paris-Normandy axis by December 2024. And my guess is that if this is a success, then it'll be replicated along the other motorways in France, but that remains to be seen. The big thing to remember is that autoroutes in France are run by private companies. So the one that runs the A13 and the A14 motorways is Sanef, and they've decided to do this independently. Other road companies could follow suit in the future, but so far I haven't seen any announcements yet.
Okay, that A14 you mentioned there, coming out of Paris, it is a bit ridiculous. You drive, you hit a toll booth, you pay €2, you drive a bit more, you pay another €2. That's kind of one of the most annoying, I think, péage in all of France, in my experience. Now, what about listeners might be curious about how this will affect people on holiday in France if you're renting a car or driving one without French registration plates? What about them? What do we know?
Well, for rental cars, we do have an answer. So you can follow the same process as everyone else. You'll put the license plate number in and then either pay online using the Sanef website or in the Tabac. You can also purchase a toll booth badge and have that and put it in your rental car and use that too. That's totally an option. It's a little bit less clear about people with non-French license plates. We've sent a couple of emails to Sanef. We're waiting to hear back from them. But for now, just watch the space, basically. We're going to have more information coming up in the near future on that.
Okay, very interesting change afoot there, Jen. Thanks to Jen. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, John. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thanks for tuning in. And just a note, you tune in earlier next week because we will publish the podcast a day earlier because...
it's a public holiday.
It's a public holiday. We are approaching the month of May. It is public holiday bonanza. May the 1st is a public holiday. So keep an eye out. Next week's podcast will, if all goes well, come out a day earlier. Be sure to tune in.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.